At the UPS store, we know being a small business owner means holiday time is still go time. Still get those orders shipped time and still re-up on stamps and supplies time. That's why this upcoming holiday, while others close up shop, we'll be open and happy to help you keep being unstoppable. Come into your local store today. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. The UPS store. Be unstoppable.
You're listening to Nightmare on Film Street. The current time is 6:66. Traffic is clear ahead from here to the afterlife, but it's hell outside. For the next hour, you're on Nightmare Time. So, let's give a grave welcome to our hosts, John and Kim.
Hello again, fiends, and welcome to Nightmare on Film Street, the horror movie podcast for the casually obsessed. I'm John.
I'm Kimmy.
And this week we are kicking off, first off, RIP Halloween. Unfortunately, welcome to November, everybody. It's not October.
Depressing.
That is the billboard tagline for November. It's not October. But we're not going to let that get us down. We're kicking off a whole month here on the podcast of Crypt Picks. As you've probably heard, we wrote a book. It's called Cocktails from the Crypt.
And it's coming out the end of this month, November 26th.
That's right. It is a collection of spooky horror movie themed cocktails, 60 cocktails, 60 terrifying cocktails based on 60 of your favorite horror movies.
And we're doing all of them this month.
And we're doing them all. Get ready, everybody. 60 podcasts in 30 days.
So realistically, what we've done is we have cherry picked 4 really awesome movies that will be featured in the book with a cocktail pairing.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about them. But this week is a little special because it's a rebroadcast of a classic Nightmare on Film Street episode. And by classic, I mean it came out earlier last year.
It came out earlier this year because it is now, this week, the 40th anniversary of Wes Craven's A Nightmare on Elm Street.
That's pretty cool.
Pretty fucking rad. You know, it's been 40 years strong. Like, goddamn, this movie still holds up. We watched it at Panic Fest with a live audience. Our first time seeing it at a theater that wasn't a drive-in movie theater. And goddamn, this movie still plays. There were a bunch of people in the audience who hadn't seen the movie yet. And we were all gasping like it was our first time seeing it. It's so great. We also hosted a Q&A with Heather Langenkamp afterward. And she is the sweetest.
Yeah, so many great stories from the set. And you're going to hear them.
The cocktail that we made to pair with A Nightmare on Elm Street is called Freddy's Boilermaker. This just seemed like the perfect move. It's a very simple cocktail.
I mean, if you've ever had a Boilermaker, you know it's a very simple cocktail.
Yeah, this is a cocktail we've all had in our 20s. But we'd put a little Freddy Krueger twist on it. I'm really excited to tell you guys about it. Yeah, well, you'll hear all about it at the end of the episode. You've probably seen some of the posts that we've put out for Cocktails from the Crypt. We're highlighting 4 of the cocktails from the book this month, but we have been sharing recipes and behind-the-scenes sneak peeks for the last 2 months on social media.
We're also doing tons of launch party stuff the end of this month. If you are near us in Winnipeg, there will be a launch party on the 30th. We are also doing one in Kansas City, Missouri on December 7th. And virtually, if you are in neither of those locations, the day after the official release on November 26th, November 27th, we'll be doing an online watch party celebration. We'll do a live cocktail demo and some other fun stuff. So join us for that launch. Listen to these cool episodes teasing recipes from the book and get ready for Cocktails from the Crypt.
You can find links to pre-order the book in the episode description wherever you're listening to this. We'll have some more info for you after our chat with Heather Langenkamp.
Oh boy, I've seen that movie at sleepover parties and drive-ins, and it gets better every time. Let's give it up one more time for Nightmare on Elm Street, everybody.
I forgot it was so funny. I hadn't seen it like in an audience proper. I saw it at a drive-in. You don't really hear the laughter at a drive-in. But it was great to have everybody laughing together. I did not realize it was so funny.
Oh, yeah. It's a blast. And let's give it up one more time for the star of Nightmare on Elm Street, Heather Langenkamp. Yeah, come on up. Yeah, have a seat. There's a microphone right there.
Whoa! I like this living room setup.
Yeah. We're going to do some audience questions as well at the end, so if you've got anything that you want asked, keep it in mind. And then we've got a microphone over here set up.
We'll give you guys a heads up when you got like 5 minutes you can line up.
So, you know, we've all got the benefit of hindsight, and we've all had nightmares about this movie for the last 40 years, but what was it like, you know, when you first read the screenplay? What were your first impressions of it?
Well, I wasn't that familiar with horror movies, actually, so I didn't imagine what those kills were going to be like. I thought they would be, you know, what we were kind of normally used to in murder mysteries or, you know, thrillers. And, yeah, they're just so much more beyond my own imagination. Even now, watching them, I just can't believe how fanciful and just so bloody. And I never conceived that they would be like that. That's for sure. I didn't really know like much about horror when I took the job, so I just looked at her as like a really all-American teenager and who had similar upbringing as I. I mean, I'm from Tulsa, you know, so she's like really wholesome and, you know, I just really tried to bring all that I could, knowing, you know, what Wes Craven was looking for. And he, too, is from Missouri. So he, you know, he had a lot of the same notions about this young lady, this woman. And I just could immediately feel like he really appreciated what I had brought to the audition the day that I went. It was just a very, you know, I mean, it was like that. It was just like, a girl, you know, just a girl.
I mean, that's underselling. She's very resilient and she's the heroine of the whole movie.
Well, I mean, she's strong, you know, but she's not that special, you know. I feel like we all have definitely a lot of Nancy in ourselves, but she, you know, on the face doesn't look that she's that special, you know. She just looks kind of ordinary. I mean, and so I tried to bring that, like, not, you know, just something that was just really kind of salt of the earth. I hate to say that, but something that everybody could identify with. And so, and I just kind of told myself when I went into the audition, I'm not going to do anything fancy. I'm not going to try to be anything. I'm just going to be as honest and real as I can. And I was lucky enough to read with Amanda Wiss in the reading because we were paired up, and the scene at the sleepover party where we, you know, I do the little thing with my finger, you know, fingers, like the scratching of Freddy. Like I did that in the audition and Amanda did the same things that she did. And Wes Craven told us in the audition that we had the part. So that was like something that's never happened since. And I just, it was really thrilling to know that right there in the moment in front of the director and the casting director that you had the part.
Now you said you weren't really into horror initially. Did Wes set you up with any movies? Did he want you to watch any specific horror movies?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, I actually had no idea who Wes Craven was. I mean, Robert Englund had said, yeah, he did this movie called Last House on the Left, but it's going to be impossible to find. They never show it. And we didn't have VCRs back then. There was no way to see a film that somebody recommended to you. You know, kind of think about that.
Dark like, days.
I mean, if you happen to stay up at midnight every night and watch midnight movies, you might have been able to catch something. But yeah, it was really hard to go and do research like that, and so I didn't. I just decided, yeah, I'll just be Nancy, you know, just be what I can, bring whatever I can to this part.
Well, to be fair, Nancy didn't really like Evil Dead, so.
And I don't know if watching Last House on the Left before that audition really would have helped much. You're like, this guy might.
Yeah, I don't know. He was such a kind and he looked very, you know, he looked like your uncle. I mean, he did not look like somebody who would make these kinds of images, whatever that stereotype would be. He always wore a tie. He was always wore khakis and a plaid shirt and a tie. He was very preppy and And we all made fun of him for that. He was very much like, he looked like a college professor, which, you know, he had been. And it was just really hard to square what was actually in his imagination with who he looked, what he looked like on the outside. It was very different, and none of us really could believe it.
Yeah, like, I think we're all pretty big fans of his work, but most of us haven't had the opportunity to work with him. What's he like on set when he's directing you guys, especially like a younger cast that maybe hasn't been in a bunch of horror movies?
Oh, he loves being around young people, and he, I could tell like that it really was what he loved to do. Is he liked to write those parts for kids, and he had kids at that time, so he was... You know, I'm always amazed at how charming the dialogue is. Even, you know, he was a little bit of a generation older than we were, but he tried really hard to make those parts realistic, and just the relationships between the teenagers as really realistic as possible. But he and Jacques Haitkin, they were constantly, and that the cinematographer, constantly discussing, you know, the shots, and he was so concerned about, you know, actually the setup of every shot and making everything move, and the dolly shots, lots of dolly shots. And like the things like the bathtub scene was very technically complicated. We covered that scene, I don't know, at maybe 8 or 9 different camera positions, and spent the whole day doing that scene. So I found that he kind of let us actors do what we were bringing and didn't have too much to say about it, and was really concerned with a lot of the technical aspects of the camera and the, and, you know, setting up the shots themselves. But we didn't do rehearsal or, I mean, we ran through it. Choreography, you know, Robert and I did a lot of choreography for the fight scenes, and sometimes the stunt coordinator would come and help us map it out. But in general, he was a very hands-off kind of director. And, you know, I do think a lot of the comedy that actually comes through is because he did let things just, you know, some of Ronnie's lines are just, you know, they weren't supposed to be funny, but they just were. And I think he probably saw it in dailies. We saw dailies every day at lunchtime. We would all sit in a little theater very similar to this. And that's where I learned what horror was in the dailies. I really could understand, oh, yeah, okay. I get what a scary movie's about, yeah, and I understand how he's making it, and, you know, the setup, the payoff, the joke, the laugh, the release, like all of those things, the formula that he had in his own mind was so accurate, you know, and it was really why he's so good at his what he did.
That's awesome.
And the laughter is like such an integral part of the frights too. You know, you have to have it. Yeah.
Yeah. You need the balance. You need to have some levity so that the next time the scare comes,
you have to relax between two very frightening moments, or else you don't have anywhere to go. So you have to kind of always have this sine curve of, you know, tension, release, tension, release.
Yeah. And I think Nightmare on Elm Street maybe does it the best, like oscillating between, you know, laughter, levity, and then a crazy special effects sequence.
Yeah. It was really, I don't know if he knew how to do it, but he certainly learned in that movie, because some of his other movies, they also have a lot of humor. You know, he was a very dark-witted person, very, he had a very dark sense of humor, but he also had a really playful, he was a very playful person as well, and loved to play practical jokes on you, or, you know, just pull your leg, you know, and there was lots of different kinds of humor that he used. And then Robert England, who was so funny too. They made a very jolly set. It was always like a lot of laughs.
Was it hard then to see Freddy Krueger when like the cameras went on?
You know, we're not together that much, me and Freddy, actually, when you look at the movie. So most of my hardest work was like trying to judge like how tired I was, or how crazy I was, or how frustrated I was. Like, I was always modulating like scenes where I would go from like being really tired and being very energetic, and like making it look like it could be one girl's life in the course of 1 week. So Wes would help me with that a lot. Like, he'd be like, okay, you've started here, you need to go there, and we had like a little shorthand. But in general, I mean, it was one of my first movies that I had ever done, so the most important thing that Wes did for me, frankly, was to let me know that I was doing okay. Because I, as many people, you're always worried and you're insecure and you're not sure you know what you're doing. And I mean, I would be telling Johnny Depp, like, okay, that X there, that's your mark, you know, and you're supposed to stand on that so that the guy who's focusing, who's actually a woman, Anne, like, can have you in focus. If you're off that mark, then you won't be in focus and we'll have to do the scene again. And he's like, oh, that's what that's for. Like, and I'd be like, now, if you're going to scream, you have to tell the sound man in advance, because otherwise you're going to blow his eardrums out because he won't have, you know, the dial set to the right level. And then the only reason that I told him that is because of the day before I had got a lecture from the sound man, because I hadn't told him that I was going to be screaming. And it was, you know, I was always like learning something on Monday and then telling Johnny about it on Tuesday.
So it was, move.
Because he was even less experienced than I was. So, you know, we both were completely, you know, novices. And then you had Robert Englund, who was he was well-trained, classically trained actor, and he had a lot of advice for us. And all of those bedroom scenes where I'm fighting Freddy are all choreographed by Robert Englund. He knew when to do this and where to put the glove. And, you know, he would tell me, you look that way, and then my glove will be here, and it'll look really great, and the light will glint off of it. I mean, Wes Craven didn't have to do any work. Robert was like, he was so into his sword fighting classes at RADA that he could just, you know, bring them all to our set, and he taught us so much about that.
Well, it sounds like you guys had, like, such a great time.
We did. That's why we're really good friends still, because, I mean, that really the only tension on the set was, you know, once in a while, we had to go and get our own lunches. It was such a low budget. They didn't bring us lunch. We would go get a sandwich or something down the street and then come back. But since I usually had to be in makeup, somebody would usually bring me a lunch. But everybody else was going out and getting lunch. And a couple of times, there happened to be like a little Mexican place where they served really great margaritas. And so couple cast members would like be, you know, enjoying a margarita on a, you know, before they're wrapped, and that was like kind of a little tense there. You can probably guess who that character was.
I'm sure they were just trying to go method and make themselves look extra sleepy.
I know. But sometimes, you know, there would be, you know, Ronnie Blakely would go from the makeup trailer into her, you know, dressing room and kind of add some makeup to her look. Because she wanted to look a little bit more, I think a little bit more glamorous than I think Wes had in mind. And so there was a little tension there too. Because I think that Wes is so polite. I don't think he really knew how to say, what are you doing? You know, like, and so she had this different look than all of us on the set. We all had very natural makeup. But it actually just adds so much in retrospect to have her be that way.
She's such a queen in this movie.
Yeah.
So what was like the day that you had the most fun on set, and what was the hardest day? Like, whether it was like a technical special effect you guys were trying to accomplish or just something that was really challenging.
I mean, the bathtub scene was very challenging because I was in the water all day long. And, you know, that scene is actually two or three different setups. We had the I'm in the bathtub. It's actually a 8-foot deep plywood tank, probably lined, you know, with, you know, tar, silicone, whatever they used back then. But only that bathtub shell was at the top. And then the scuba diving Jim Doyle was underneath me in a scuba outfit and gear. And so that was a very long day. And Wes would cue him because he couldn't hear anything. So Wes would just like bang on the side of the tub, and then he'd see the hand come up and then down, and then bang, bang, bang. And then he'd be like, you know, so all day long, which is like bang, bang, bang. And then that little claw would come up and down. It was like a game. That day was hard. I was sitting on a little 2x4 across the, you know, across the span of the tank. So, you know, it was not that comfortable. And then the water would get cold, and then they would get me out, heat the water up, make more bubbles. I was very modest, you know, so I was worried that there weren't enough bubbles all the time. And that was like the most not fun day. But I knew that, like I said, we saw dailies the next day when I saw it, I just said, this scene is so great. This is going to be the best scene in the movie. But then every time I saw like Tina's death scene, or then I saw Johnny's death scene, then I would say, oh, no, that one's going to be the best scene in the movie. And I mean, Johnny's death is really so good. And everybody knows that story now, because that blood comes out. That's a rotating room. When the room is upside down, they just pour the blood out, you know, gallons and gallons, probably 500 gallons of blood. And then they start rotating the room with the intention of having all the blood drip down the side of the walls and covering all of his posters and covering everything in his room with blood. But the guys on the axle rotated the room the wrong way. And so all the blood just went shooting out the open wall. And there was no effect, you know. It was just like, it looked like a clean room again, except with some red on the ceiling. And so...
Did anybody get soaked?
Again. It was only a one-take deal. So Wes, in the editing, which you can see what he did, is he just made that kind of mysterious whooshing of air, like wind from hell, that, you know, blows all the blood out of the room. And yet that scene, because everyone's reacting, you don't really ever get to see the final room. You see the mom screaming, then you see everybody vomiting, you see everybody like going, the coroner's in, you know, been puking ever since he got here. So you don't ever really see what the room looked like. It's just all the dialogue supports this idea that it was just so disgusting. But I don't think it actually really was when we shot it. It didn't really work for the way they wanted it to.
One of my favorite effects in the entire film, and it's not even, there's so many big ones, but this one's tiny. It's when you're going up the stairs and you're sinking down into the steps. And I read somewhere that it was pancake mix.
Yeah, I think it was like pancake mix and maybe oatmeal or cream of mushroom soup or anything that's kind of disgusting and gray looking they put in there. But that was actually the producer, Bob Shea's nightmare. He wanted to contribute a nightmare experience that he had. And so that was his idea. And I think Wes did it out of like, okay, producer wants this. And yet it's actually like one of the really, really compelling moments, right?
It's such nightmare logic. Like you can't move fast enough. It really.
And you're sinking in like so many. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people's nightmares are incorporated into that movie in different ways. So, yeah, it's great to see it every time I see it. I love it.
I know the effects in this movie like hold up so well. Like they look incredible now still.
Except for Marge going into the bed. I don't know. That looks
really bad.
I know the fact that she waves before she goes.
It's like Jason and the Argonauts to me, like, you know, from like way back in the 70s.
But it's also cool to hear you talk about them in such detail and like how you have such clear memory about them and like seeing them in the dailies.
They're all really clear to me. And I mean, 40 years has gone by. There's other days that I can't remember at all, you know. Though I do remember like in one of the scenes, it's a very short moment in the film, but I'm luring Freddie out at the final scene. You know, I'm luring him through the alleyway and I kick over a trash can, and then you see me like in the front yard or something like that. And in that moment where I'm kicking over the trash can, I stepped on something in the, it was an indoor set, but a piece of glass, and I sliced my foot open. And it was one of those days where we probably had like 3 days worth of things to shoot, but only one day to shoot them. And so it was so fast. Everyone was just like crazy throwing props, you know, into the, you know, just throwing everything together to try to get some final, you know, final scenes done. And the producer was like, do you really have to go to the hospital? I'm like, yeah, you know, my foot is bleeding. And so he, I think, drove me to Hollywood Presbyterian Hospital, which if you ever go there, it's like one of the worst hospitals in LA. And they just kind of bandaged up my foot. And then I'm like, back to work, you know, like I like, put my slipper on and like, we're good to go. And it was, you know, in any other production, they probably would have taken an insurance day maybe, or let me just have an hour to like rest.
I bet that's a day that you were yearning for one of those margaritas.
Yeah, I really probably needed one then. Yeah. But yeah, I worked really hard. I mean, that's the one thing I do remember is getting there so early and working really hard all day, going home. Some nights I would drive Nick Corey, back then, now he's J. Sue Garcia, but I would drive him to Hollywood after we were done because he, you know, had friends that he was staying with. He was kind of couch surfing at the time. So he'd be like, could you drive me over to like Wilton and Santa Monica? And I'm like, sure. You know, and so I would drive him home and then I would go home and then pick him up in the morning. And so I was like carpooling with him. It was crazy. It really was. And we were all just so, we were just really young and, you know, flexible. And that it was great that way.
Spark something uncommon this holiday with just the right gift from Uncommon Goods. Look, the holiday season's almost here. I'm bummed out about it too. I wish it could be Halloween forever. But Uncommon Goods makes the holiday season less stressful with incredible hand-picked gifts for everyone on your list all in one spot. They scour the globe for original handmade, absolutely remarkable things. Somehow they know exactly the perfect gift for every single person you know. I'm on their website right now, actually. They have these really cool, it says adult scary movie night bingo cards. I don't know what makes them adult. Maybe it's just that like, oh, somebody gets their head cut off. But I could totally use these. These would be great at a home party. Oh, they also have, this is actually really cool. My sister has one of these. It's a 100 horror movie scratch off chart. So it's like a poster. It's got 100 of the best horror movies ever made. And you scratch them off as you watch them. I haven't met a single person yet who has that entire chart scratched off. I've seen this in a couple people's apartments. And it's actually really fun. It's like having a watch list right there in your living room. If you don't know what to watch, you just look at the chart. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. Many of their handcrafted products are made in small batches, so shop now before they sell out this holiday season. I mean, honestly, even that scratch-off chart says there's only 5 left. You got a little bit of time. And to get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/nightmare. That's uncommongoods.com/nightmare for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
You said you realized like when you were watching the dailies, like, oh, this is going to be really scary and this is going to be great. Did you kind of have that feeling while you're on set that you guys are really going to make something great, something monumental?
I knew that we were working... I mean, everyone was so professional, and working with John Saxon, he really brought the level of everybody's professionalism up a lot because he was the real movie star and we all wanted to impress him. And I was scared of him. He was really like intimidating to me. But he had a great sense of humor, you know, and he wore a toupee in that, if you can't tell, I mean, but he would like have several different ones that he would use for of his different movies. And so I remember when he first came in to do his costume and wardrobe testing, you know, they were kind of trying on different, you know, hair pieces that would make him look like a good cop, you know, and it was just like he was such a old movie star. He just had all the, he has the stories, man. You know, he'd work with, gosh, everybody.
Yeah, the more I watch this movie, the relationship between your two characters is the thing that like I'm always fascinated with. It seems so natural.
But this one, I watching it today, I actually felt like our relationship was so much better than it was a secret. It was like a quiet intensity of our love for each other that we don't tell anybody about or something. Because I felt it really strongly today watching it, and there were some looks that he gave me that I don't think I'd noticed before or something that. I mean, I've seen this movie so many times now that I'm looking like really small things on the side to kind of freshen it for myself. And yeah, I watched John's performance very closely tonight. And yeah, there was really touching moments, actually, even though, you know, I'm yelling and screaming at his...
Let me out!
get my dad, you asshole! That's such a great... yeah. That's also Nancy.
I know we get the opportunity to explore your relationship more in A New Nightmare, and like that's what's been so great about your character in these movies is that, you know, years before we got all these legacy sequels, we had the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise to sort of explore like the fallout of that character. And I mean, you are playing a fictionalized version of yourself there, but you know,
you get to see and follow her in a really natural way through, you know, being a teenager here and then being a young adult. in Nightmare 3, and then being a woman and a mother. And it's very rare to have a character who can span that many different experiences, that not only for just a woman, but for a person going through so much experience. And I just know how lucky I am to have had that opportunity to play a character like that. And have Wes, you know, he's always told me that he just really believed that Nancy and Freddie were like a unit, like the same two sides of a different coin. And he always liked us together. You know, that's why he wrote those scripts, to have us, you know, always battling each other. And so Wes, you know, in his concept, Nancy and Freddie, yeah, I think they'll just keep fighting forever. You know, that's in my book. They're going to have some other battle. I don't know what it'll be, but I always dream about it.
So you are talking legacy sequel then?
In my imagination, I have several legacy sequels happening at the same time.
That's a character you'd be willing to return to if.
God, yes. I mean, of course, yeah. She's a great character. How could you say no? Yeah.
Such great news to hear. I'm sure it's the number one question everybody has on their minds, right?
I just need somebody to, yeah, get that off the ground. But especially considering Nightmare on Elm Street Part 7, Wes Craven's new nightmare, I do think there's a lot of really great opportunities for new and excellent, you know, battles still to come.
Yeah, and you know, like, we'd love to open the questions up to the audience if anybody would like to sort of like come form a line over here by the microphone so we can hear you. Don't be shy. You can do it.
Ask me something really, really cool and never before.
Yeah, no pressure, guys. Ask her a question no one's ever asked her in the last 4 years.
Check.
But I mean, recently, like, what's it been like to turn to the horror genre? Like, you've been doing a lot more roles recently.
I've been really, I just decided, well, first of all, I think when you get older, the roles are way better. I mean, and not better, they're different. And so now I find that I'm offered a lot of different kinds of roles in the horror genre that are more interesting to me than the ones that I was offered after I did Nancy, which are always very similar to Nancy. And I usually would say no, because I just felt like once I had played Nancy Thompson, that any other character that was remotely similar wouldn't work. And even though the filmmakers probably thought it would be, oh, really great, I just couldn't ever invest my heart into storylines that were too close to hers. And you know, in my heart of hearts, I did want to get out of the horror genre a little bit. I want to, you know, experiment with other things. And so, luckily now that I'm, you know, old, I'm being offered parts that are really crazy and out there, like really out there. And so I'm really intrigued by doing things that are really outside of the Nancy, like, universe, like not playing the heroine or the one who, you know, is fighting. I want to be the monster. I want to be the evil character. I think that would be a way of still being in the horror genre, but playing the other side of it.
Well, I mean, you've been kind of making monsters now behind the scenes. You and your husband have a
right. We make a lot of monsters. Yeah, that's been, you know, really eye opening just to be part of my husband's business. He creates all of these monsters, and we actually got really kind of sick of it after a while, because, you know, you're always the pressure to create like a really unique monster. Like, everybody is really not opinionated, but just like well versed in all the monsters that have ever been. And so the assignment to do something new and groundbreaking and never been seen before and so scary and never, you know, so that's watching my husband do that now for 30 years. It's really hard. And, but I mean, he's managed some really great characters, and I've watched him and I go, how did he do that? But, you know, characters like Twisty the Clown and I mean, Dawn of the Dead, the remake, there's a lot of great zombies in there. And yeah, it's always, and oh gosh, I don't know if you ever saw American Horror Story Hotel, but the bed, like the addiction demon that comes out, is really a really great monster that, you know, I tell my husband, I'm like, I hope that part of you that invented him is like nowhere near me ever.
I think Greg might have got a fix, but maybe not. But give it up for Greg Dedrick.
Yay.
Best to get it going. There we go. Hey, the Panic Fest roadie who could. Thank you, Greg.
Oh,
really
kicking stuff.
Quick. You kind of were touching base on this a little bit. Yeah, it might not be working, but Scary Gary's got the voice that can travel across.
Yeah, great voice.
Anyways, you were talking a little bit Thank you. About New Nightmare on the End, that's kind of like where my question was going towards. How did you feel when you got that phone call for the meta movie that was way ahead of its time? And how did you feel about, like, is this going to work or not?
Yeah, that's exactly what I said. I'm like, oh, poor Wes. He's been, you know, kind of out of it for a few years. He just wants to, he has this opportunity to write a script for Bob Shea, and he's written something that is so out there. Like, I just don't think anyone's going to understand it. And I don't want to play this girl named Heather Langenkamp. I'm just like, there's no way that I'm going to do a good job. But, you know, I mean, I knew that, I mean, the opportunity to work with Wes Craven was obviously such a gift. And I had to first convince my husband that it would be okay. And then I had to read the scripts, you know, many, many times to kind of really, I'm just not that smart sometimes when I'm reading the script, because I didn't know Nightmare on Elm Street was really that much of a horror movie. And so then New Nightmare, I'm like, I don't get it. Like, what? And so finally I kind of understood what he was getting at. And then I said, well, okay, I mean, since I'm probably never going to be in another Nightmare on Elm Street movie, I said, I want the same deal that Robert Englund's getting. And then they're like, well then we're going to have to pass. We'll have to get someone else to play the part. And so I was like, what? Okay, I forget I said that. I'll do it.
Well, as Wes said in the end of the movie, thank you for playing Nancy one more time.
Oh, thank you.
That was a good question.
First thing, I have to say that I saw this when I was 12 years old, and it was not funny at all.
No, no, you didn't laugh. You know that.
But how many days did it take to film?
It was about 25 days. It was 5 weeks.
Oh, shit.
And that was pretty much, yeah, it was a very short, very quick kind of schedule. I mean, in those days, movies, they took a lot longer to film because you were dealing with film, and it took a lot of time to change the film, and it was so expensive. So I think that that's all they could afford was about 25 days.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Hi, Heather.
Hi.
So last year I watched The Midnight Club. I'm a fan of Mike Flanagan.
Yes.
And your performance was one of my favorite parts of the show.
Oh, thank you.
So I'm just curious, what interested you in that project? How'd you get involved? And what were you looking for when you read the script?
Well, I got a call. It was in January of 20. It was pandemic. In the pandemic. Maybe 2021. Or 2022, I can't even remember, but I got this call. There's a part for you that is in Mike Flanagan's show, and they have a scene they'd like you to read. Can you do it by 5 o'clock tomorrow night and get it to the casting director? And so I got a scene of a woman who owns a hospice for kids with cancer, and I read it, and I just went, this is really, it was a Mike Flanagan speech, you know, it was like, two full pages of dialogue, monologue. Right. And I really couldn't believe that I was getting it. And I was like, oh, okay, a guest star part, that's great. I'm totally excited to do it. And I memorized this speech and I got it in at like 4:59 p.m. because I did about 900 takes because I didn't want one word to be wrong. And when you're doing one big monologue that's several pages long, I mean, the minute that you have to start over again, you know, because when you're self-taping, you can't really cut it together or anything like that. So I told my husband, just keep it rolling, you know, until I get it perfectly. And so finally I got a perfect take. It was about 4:15 in the afternoon and they were calling like, where is it? They're looking for it. And I'm like, it's coming. And I uploaded the audition. And then that night they're like, they love it. And I didn't realize, but Mike Flanagan was a huge Nightmare on Elm Street fan, and he had wanted to have me play this part, but I only thought it was one episode. And then when they said, you know, the contract's going to come in the mail or over the internet, you got to look at it. And then I realized that it was for the whole series, 10 episodes, Netflix. I just thought I had died and gone to heaven. And it was heaven. It was so much fun. And plus it was also up in Vancouver. So, you know, it was the pandemic, so it was not a lot of fun to shoot it because it was very masky and lots of shields and a lot of time alone in my, you know, my little cubicle. They only brought you to set like 1 minute before we were going to roll camera. So it was really not fun in the way that you imagine things are going to be. But yeah, Mike Flanagan, you know, he didn't know that my son had just died of brain cancer. And so I'm, you know, telling him the day I arrive in Vancouver, like, did you know that, you know, this character whose son has died of brain cancer, like, is like me? And he had no idea. And he just, and I just thought, the universe is working in really mysterious ways.
Well, I love your performance, so everyone check it out if you haven't seen it yet. And I'm glad you're still working, still acting.
Well, I know, and I got to play, and he brought me in to play a little part in His Life of Chuck, which I'm really excited about and comes out, I hope, this year, but I'm imagining that in the fall sometime. Right. Really great, great script. Not as maybe scary as people are used to from Mike Flanagan, but it's a Stephen King novella, and it has a lot of really interesting, very meta moments in it, too. Very interesting script. So I play a character named Ruth. You'll get to see me in that. But it was fun.
Well, looking forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have no idea where to stand for this. Is this working? Can you hear me? So, you got your crash course on filmmaking on set.
Yeah.
And in that time, do you feel like there's something that you took from that experience that has just carried through your entire career, whether it be film, television, something that you feel is just was like a game changer for you and that you would pass on to others with that in mind?
Well, with the help of, you know, with Wes's help and being able to, I trusted him a lot to tell me if I was no good. And I would often ask him, like, is that okay? And he would say, yes, that was fine. Or if, you know, he'd say, well, let's do it another time. You know, then I would know that maybe I needed to try something else. But what I learned is that you just have to commit to whatever you're going to do. You have to commit so hard to it that you forget what you've done. Like, you know, when you, I mean, if you're a woman, you've had a baby, like, you don't even remember what it was like to have the baby. You just were so committed to that enterprise that it, you know, and you don't even remember anything about it. But after every take, I kind of felt like that's what I wanted to feel like, that I couldn't even tell you if I got my lines right, or I couldn't even tell you if I was drooling or like spit on him or something that, you know, I didn't intend to do. But when I see it up on the screen now, I can tell the moments when I have that 100%, like in the classroom when I freak out. Like, I am so freaking out for real, and I'd have no little person on my shoulder looking at me freaking out or judging how I'm freaking out or telling me, like, you're not doing a very good job freaking out. You know, we all have that critical voice inside of our head that if you can just banish it and just be a fool, take a chance, do it crazy one time. If you have someone like Wes Craven or any director who is really watching, they'll be able to tell you, like, maybe went over the top too much that time, or I didn't like it when you did that. But you just have to commit to it that hard, because otherwise I think you can always tell when they're not 100% there, you know. And the line readings that don't work for me are the ones where I can tell that I'm watching myself. You know, my little critical Heather Langenkamp is sitting on my shoulder telling me to do it this way or do it that way, rather than just doing it from your gut and just see what happens.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. It sounds like being present and in the moment is like the takeaway, and I love that.
Yeah, and that allows you to like really listen to your co-stars too. And, you know, especially when you're new, you think like, okay, if I just practice my lines in my dressing room and then I just go out there and do that same great line reading that I did in the dressing room when I was looking in the mirror, you know, that it's going to work. But it actually just really does never, ever works that way. You just have to be ready to be an idiot and make a total fool of yourself and know that everyone around you wants you to succeed. And if you feel that way, then you do trust everybody. And when you're on a set, when you aren't with people that you trust, it's really, really hard to do a good job. And so building trust is probably one of the first things I would tell anybody who's making a film. It's like, how are you going to do that? Because you want that person to feel like they could be totally naked, literally or figuratively, in front of you and everybody else who is there. That's the one secret that I've kept with me since I worked with Wes Craven.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your insight. Thank you.
And warning the sound guy that you're going to scream.
Yeah, warning the sound guy that you're going to scream.
We got time for one more question.
I just want to know, what's the longest you've ever gone without sleeping?
Well, it actually has something to do with my career. So when I worked in Tulsa, I was a senior in high school, just graduated, and I had a job at the Tulsa Tribune. I was a copy girl, which means that you type in births and deaths and you take copy up and down the stairs to the print room. And in the olden days when people actually laid it out on these big, galleys. And so I had woken up and I had seen the ad to go down and audition for The Outsiders. And I went in at noon and, had my Polaroid taken. And then that night, they said that you got the job. And so it was like, okay, that night I slept. And then I worked the next day at this high school scene in The Outsiders. And so maybe like a week or two later, they were shooting Rumblefish. And I was still working. And I got the call in the morning that I had to work on the set at Rumblefish. And so I woke up, I worked all day, I worked all night at Rumblefish, and then I had to work all day the next day. And so that was the longest I'd ever stayed up, and I realized, I could never do that more than one time in my life. It was so hard. And every time I went to the lady, I would take these breaks, and I would just, literally lay down on the floor, try to, take a nap for 5 minutes and then get back up. It was so exhausting. That's the longest. It was, 40 hours, probably, that I stayed
up. Yikes. Thank you for playing Nancy, and Dream Warriors Nancy is still the best. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all so much for coming out. Let's give it up one more time for Heather Langenkamp, everybody.
Thank you again to Heather Langenkamp for taking the time to talk with us. And of course, thank you so much to everybody at Panic Fest for joining and for hosting. This was so much fun. Easily one of the best nights of the year.
Yeah, we cannot wait to be back in December for the U.S. launch party of the book. We're going to be doing a screening there of Cabin in the Woods and a cocktail pairing that I think you're going to want to try. It's definitely a little merman-ish.
As we mentioned at the top of the show, we're highlighting A Nightmare at Elm Street, not just because it's the 40th anniversary this year, but because we have a cocktail in the book about it.
Actually, we have a whole dang slasher chapter. This is just one of the cocktails in that chapter that's slasher-related.
Yeah, to the chapter is called Slashed, Not Stirred. There's a lot of really cool cocktails in there. Freddy's Boilermaker is... Man, this is a great drink. Also, was very hard to get a photograph of this drink.
Yeah, hopefully I have some videos that I can share on social media when this episode drops, because there was a lot of splashing and ill-timed photographs.
Oh my God.
And messes were made.
Yeah, if you've ever had a Boilermaker before, there's a couple of different ways to do it. There's the sneaky way where you just take a swig out of a beer and then you just fill the neck back up with whiskey, which I don't recommend, because then the next sip is just whiskey. It's a bad move, but it works. What we did for the Freddy's Boilermaker, we went that classic route where you're dropping a shot into a pint of beer, for this one, just to get the mood of the boiler room and to sort of give that that fiery sense from Freddy Krueger himself. We used a dark amber ale and some cinnamon whiskey. It's fucking delicious.
It's a really good drink.
But yeah, we made such a mess. And it wasn't even the last drink of the day on the photo shoot. It took us about almost a week to take all the photos for the entire book. And halfway through the day, we decided, let's just start making the place smell like beer. It's like we got hung up on trying to get an action shot of the shot glass going into the pint, exploding.
But also
everywhere.
Simultaneously, we wanted fog creeping in.
Oh, it's sometimes you'd get the perfect shot, but the fog wouldn't look good, or it would be splashing in the wrong direction, or the idiot. Dropped the shot glass on the side of the pint, and it just went sideways on the table.
There were a couple shots too where you could just see John's hand in it.
Yeah, so get ready for some of the behind-the-scenes footage of this one. You can find any of that on, you know, TikTok or Instagram.
The final shot, though, is amazing. Oh, my God. It's so perfect, it looks fake.
Like, they almost used it for the cover of the book.
Yeah, the splash on the drink looks just... I've never marveled at a splash before, but this is a good one.
Yeah, it's also a dangerous drink, right? Because for some reason, dropping a shot into another drink, you have this expectation, like, oh, I have to drink all of this right now, immediately.
It adds, like, a countdown. For some reason, you're like, gotta chug it.
But I'll give you a word of warning. You have two or three of these in a row, you're gonna fall asleep. And that's the one thing you don't want to do near Freddy Krueger. But yeah, this one is truly one of my favorites from the book. You're probably gonna hear me say that a lot. Every single drink in this book is one of our babies. And that's because I would not have a drink in here that I didn't think was delicious or perfectly paired for the movie. We hope you dig Freddy's Boilermaker. I know you're a fan of A Nightmare on Elm Street. If you're listening to this podcast called Nightmare on Film Street, and we've got a ton more cocktails waiting for you. Book's coming out in the end of November. On the 26th, you can find links in this episode description right now.
Yeah, you can pre-order it now. It's everywhere books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc.
Yeah, Blackwell's, Chapter Indigo.
We have also partnered with our local bookshop, Raven's End, to give you guys signed copies. So check that out as well. That is in the link at nofspodcast.com/go.
Yeah, that's right. You can go to bookstore.org to pre-order a copy from your own local bookstore. There's also a form you can fill out at nofspodcast.com. To get a signed plate from us. We will mail you one if you pre-order this book anywhere other than Raven's End.
And you're like, damn, I want a signed copy. We're going to make it a signed copy for you.
That's right. But if you want a signed, indirectly in the book.
On the page.
We will go to Raven's End in Winnipeg and we will doodle in the book for you and we'll mail it out. And, you know, the best part about it is that you'll be supporting a local business. Raven's End is a really cool bookshop here in Winnipeg. It is a purely horror themed bookshop, and the people running it are really, really cool.
That's it from us this week. We will be back again next week with another crypt pick and another cocktail pairing. So join us then. I'm Kimmy.
I'm John.
Stay creepy.
This is a story of the one. As a maintenance specialist for university housing, he knows college students can major in wear and tear. Plus, housing so many students doesn't leave a lot of room to house all the supplies he needs. That's where Grainger comes in. With over a million industrial-grade products and fast, dependable delivery, Grainger carries the quality products he needs so he doesn't have to. From a new door hinge to a whole new faucet. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.